Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you here. And we're also happy to have again here on the program David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And for quite a while now, he's been joining us on a regular basis, once a month. It's always on a Friday, to answer questions about money management. He begins by, you know, making a few comments, sometimes has something to say about the economy. Then we open it up to questions. And if you have questions about his little topic of conversation here or anything else that has to do with investing and money management, and, you know, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter whether you're retired, whether you're just starting out, whatever question you have, you can call in, and I know he'll try to help you out. So with that, we'll say glad to have you here once again. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Before we begin discussing financial topics, however, I would like to announce that today's program will be my last regular monthly program. As I'm stepping down, David, from the, well, let's call it the co-captain's chair, so to speak, and turning the helm over to the able leadership of my good friend and colleague at the University of Illinois College of Business, Mr. Kevin Wasby. Kevin, of course, has appeared many times on Focus in my absence, and I know that our listeners will appreciate his breadth of financial knowledge. And on occasion, of course, I will be back to visit as well. Well, David, we have actually been doing this program together. I went back finally and checked it out for more than 22 years, and I have thoroughly enjoyed my affiliation with WILL and particularly yourself. It's been a privilege to work with you over these past years, and I also want to take this opportunity to personally thank you, David, for your extraordinary service to the University of Illinois and the Champaign-Urbana community. I would also like to thank Harriet Williamson, the producer of this program, for her exemplary efforts. She reminds me every month, David, when I'm supposed to be here, what time I'm supposed to be here, and takes care of all of those little, well, off-the-air items that we encounter continuously. And of course, I'd also like to echo a special thanks to the loyal supporters of WILL, and more particularly to our specific listening audience of Focus 580. You were all so tremendously appreciated. Now, as a financial counselor, on my last regularly scheduled guest appearance, I thought it would be worthwhile and perhaps appropriate to share what I believe to be a few, not all, but a few of the real financial difference makers we encounter during our lifetime. I believe this advice that I'm about to give is especially appropriate not only for our listeners, but the children and grandchildren of our listeners as well. Financial difference maker number one. This one is so simple. First and foremost, spend less than you earn. It seems so simple, yet 50% of all American households have no savings. More than 50% of all American households actually have a negative net worth. They owe more than they have. Whether you save 5%, whether you save 10%, or even 20% of your gross earnings, it is absolutely incumbent on each of us to save for our own retirement, especially in light of the long-term negative outlook on government-sponsored retirement programs. It is more important that you regularly commit to a savings strategy than really what you invest in. Let me repeat that. It's more important that you save than whether you choose a CD, whether you choose stocks, stock mutual funds, fixed income instruments. You must save for the future, whether it's 5, 10% or more. Spend less than you earn. Financially successful individuals start saving early, they start saving often, and they commit to saving approximately 15% of their gross dollar income during any calendar year. That indeed is a prescription for financial success. All right, financial difference maker number two. While almost all of us have goals, few of us commit our goals to the written word. Few of us write down our goals. A goal or a plan that is not written down is merely a pipe dream. 99 out of 100 times, that goal is not going to be reached. Financially successful people not only write their goals down, they read their goals every day, and in fact carry these written goals with them in their purses or wallets. I wonder how many of our listeners do that. I ask that question of each of my classes each year at the beginning of a semester, and I find maybe 1 in 100 students write their goals down, carry them with them, and look at them every day. And financially savvy people who write their goals down and carry them and look at them every day are continually asking themselves the following two questions. These are so important. Question number one. First, can I point to at least one action that I have taken today which will move me closer to reaching one of my goals? Now, these goals, keep in mind, might be financial, they might be social, they might be family. But most importantly, can I point to at least one action I have taken today which will move me closer to reaching at least one of my goals? Question number two. What I am doing at this very moment, whether it's reading, whether it's playing sports, whether it's listening to Focus 580, is this a bona fide use of my time from the perspective of accomplishing my goals? Is this a bona fide use of my time from the perspective of accomplishing my goals? If you read books on successful people, whether they are successful financially, politically, intellectually, academically, what you find is that they are careful planners. They write their objectives and goals down, and they continually look at them and question whether or not they are embarking on actions, doing things that will move them closer to their goals on a regular basis. Successful people are asking and answering these two questions several times a day. Financial difference maker number three. Make certain you evaluate every major buying decision from the perspective of wants versus needs. I want a new BMW. In fact, a shiny new BMW would be very, very nice in my driveway. But I need a vehicle that hauls kids, hauls my fishing equipment, gets very good gas mileage, and is not a budget buster. In other words, do not allow your emotions to influence any major buying decision. Let me repeat that. Do not allow your emotions to influence any major buying decision. Rather, research your buying decision. Write down a specific criteria with respect to what you are buying and educate yourself. Research, a written criteria, and consumer education will enable you to keep your emotions in check when contemplating a major purchase. If you follow this simple strategy, you are far more likely to have a positive, financially intelligent buying experience, and most importantly, not overspend. Financial difference maker number four. Understand that your biggest long-term financial enemy is not the stock market. It's not the bond market. It's not these ridiculously low CD interest rates that we currently have. It's not even our own government who is taxing us to death. No, our biggest financial enemy is inflation, the long, the continuous erosion of your and my buying power. At the long-term inflation rate of just 3%, a dollar today is worth just 50 cents in less than 25 years. At an annual inflation rate of some 5%, your money halves in value in approximately 14 years. Now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been publishing a retail rate of inflation for many years. It's commonly referred to as the Consumer Price Index. And this long-term rate, at least according to the Bureau, approximates 3% with various gyrations in between. However, I believe that the rate is understated, and we could go into that for any number of reasons. You can Google Consumer Price Index, CPI, and you can read all about it. There are literally pages of information about how that index is calculated, what goes into it. For example, we all know that food prices, medical costs, college tuition, and gasoline have far surpassed that 3% target. Now, how do you deal with inflation? What can you do? Historically, one of the best hedges to dealing with inflation is to commit at least some of your investable assets, and I repeat, some of your investable assets, to a diversified portfolio of stocks and stock mutual funds for the long term. As I have counseled for many, many years, not 5 years, not buying Facebook today and trying to sell it tomorrow. No. We're talking 25, 30, 35-year incremental periods of time. And over long periods of time, stocks and stock mutual funds, a well-put-together diversified portfolio, has been an excellent hedge against inflation. Not all of the time, and that's why we have to take a very, very long-term view. Which, of course, is a segue into our couch potato portfolio. Now, we recall that our portfolio consists of 8 U.S. and international stock indexes. You can follow the portfolio. It was just updated today by Harriet Williamson on the WILL website. Click on Focus, and then click on the Dave Sinnoh Couch Potato Portfolio. Now, how are we doing? Well, through last night's close, which includes a very brutal previous 2 weeks, where 8 of the previous 9 stock market trading sessions has been brutally negative, our portfolio is still treading water. In fact, we're up year-to-date approximately 3%. That's quite a drop from a month ago, as stocks and stock indexes worldwide and in the U.S. have retreated some 5 to 8%. And of course, our portfolio, interestingly enough, actually trails our benchmark. Our benchmark is the S&P 500, which is ahead more than 4.5% for the year. So our well-diversified portfolio is not outperforming our S&P benchmark, namely due to our international exposure, which approximates 30% of our overall stock market portfolio. It's no secret that Europe is being beat up. Here's my personal opinion. If we look at the GDP of Europe and then we look at Greece, Greece isn't very, very much of that GDP, somewhere between 2 and 3%. And if Greece does extricate itself and moves off the euro, then I think actually you will probably see very, very quickly a stock market rally. That's my view of things. Well, there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to talk about some of these financial difference makers even further, or certainly discuss what's on the minds of our listeners. And again, okay, it's just been such a pleasure to be with you over these, well, decades, David. It indeed has been educational for me, and I hope as well it has been educational for our listeners.
Well, I would just like to say thanks to you for all these many years of service. And now that we're coming to the point where I'm not going to be doing this anymore, I think about how many people like you there have been who have been a part of this program for 4 decades. And it's really astounding. And I appreciate all of the time that you and other folks who have been here many times and, you know, sometimes once a month or a couple of times during the year. It has enabled us to provide some service, we hope, some valuable information to listeners. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And for people who are listening now, here's your opportunity. You want to call and ask a question, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email if you'd rather do it like that. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, you have questions, you can certainly call us. And I better call my broker and cancel that big order I put in for Facebook stock.
100,000, David.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. Well, I don't want to mention any specific numbers, but it's really big. Well, and I joke, but I guess it does give you the opportunity that to again make that point that if you're thinking about investing, you have to be very careful, and something may be red hot one day. That does not mean that a month from now, or a year from now, or 2 years from now, it still will be.
Absolutely. You know, Kevin Wasby and I were visiting this morning outside. It was a beautiful sunny morning earlier today, and we were talking about Facebook and IPOs in general. And mm-hmm. Kevin reminded me that 9 out of every 10 IPOs, whether they're high tech or low tech, trade lower 1 month later. 1 out of every 10 are trading at the money or in the money, which means mm-hmm. higher than their initial offering price. So we'll stay tuned, and we'll see where Facebook falls.
All right. Well, we have some callers here. We're ready to go. And we'll start with someone in Champaign on our line 4 right here. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I will definitely miss both of you, as I've enjoyed listening to the shows. I have a question about insurance. Can you explain, please, David, what whole life or your universal life insurance is and how they differ and what you think of them?
Well, let's first of all talk about whole life insurance. Like most insurance products, you are the insured and you appoint a beneficiary who would receive some face amount of life insurance in the event of your death. Now, whole life insurance is often referred to as ordinary life insurance, or cash value life insurance, or savings value life insurance. Those four terms are sort of interchangeably utilized. In a nutshell, you pay a level premium with a whole life product, and you are promised a specific death benefit, and in addition, there is a savings account value. That savings account value is guaranteed by contract. So we might have a $100,000 death benefit. Let's just pretend that the annual premium is $2,500 and you are guaranteed a certain cash value or savings value inside that product. If you die, unfortunately, typically the way the contract reads is that the beneficiary receives the larger of the face value of the policy, the death benefit value of the policy, or the savings value of the policy, whichever is higher, but not both. If you are tired of paying your premium, for example, you've paid into it for 10, 15, 18 years, and you say to yourself, you know, I really don't want to pay another $2,500 premium, you can actually borrow the premium out of your cash value at some designated interest rate. Now you're saying to yourself, wait a second, I thought that money was mine. It's yours if you cash out the policy, if you simply say enough is enough, I don't need the policy any longer, and I cash it out, then I will have a liquidation value, which typically is very close to the savings value inside the policy. Something else about a whole life policy, and that is that some whole life policies are what are called participating policies. In other words, if the company does well, that the company declares dividends, and then dividends are added to the value of your policy. Now, dividends, what that really means is that the company had a great year, and they collected more money, earned more money, less people died than they anticipated, and they're going to pass some of those dividends back on to the owner of the whole life insurance policy. What can you do with those dividends? Well, number one, send me my dividends. I'm going to go party in Las Vegas. That's one choice. A second choice is take my dividends and apply them to my premium so I pay less premium. A third choice is to invest those dividends at some guaranteed interest rate from the insurance company. And a fourth choice, which is often used by a lot of folks, is to buy more life insurance with those dividends on a one-time basis. Because if you buy a $100,000 life insurance policy today, you die 25 years from now, and your beneficiary receives $100,000, what is that worth after inflation? So dividends can be used to buy additional life insurance called paid-up additions. Okay? At any time, however, you can cancel the policy and cash it in. Dividends are never guaranteed. Cash values are guaranteed, but not dividends. Dividends typically are not taxable as they are a return of premium. That's sort of an overview of whole life. Universal life is an amendment to a whole life policy. A universal life policy says, yes, we're going to take some of your premium and we're going to put it in a savings account, but you're going to have some control over that savings account. You can invest it in a variety of ways. You might be able to invest it in stocks. You might be able to invest it in at a guaranteed interest rate, for example. And if your cash value does well, you may indeed pay less premium to maintain that death benefit. If your cash value account does awful, then the insurance company is going to come back and say, you know, we've got to increase your premium or alternatively reduce the death benefit. So universal life provides you with additional flexibility in terms of your ability to invest the money and playing with the death benefit. Now, while both of those types of policies have places in people's portfolios, I have counseled for younger people, especially for younger people, you are probably best off buying a term life insurance product. It doesn't build cash value, and what you are paying for is the pure actuarial cost of the death benefit. In other words, it is much less expensive because it doesn't have these other factors built in, typically savings values, dividend values, and they very frankly are much less lucrative for the insurance agent. So what I would suspect and I would suggest is that for most younger people, that it makes far greater sense to buy a term life product, maybe even a level term for 10, 15, 20 years. I have, for example, 25-year level term life insurance, which covered me during the ages when my children were in college and when they were younger, etc. So you have a variety of choices, and there are any number of good books, periodicals, and texts where you can read more about each of these individual products. Great question. I hope I answered it.
You did. That was great. If I may, just have one follow-up question. For the whole life policy, you say that you've got the separate savings account established. How is it determined how much money goes in there?
That is a formula from the insurance company, but that cash value table is printed typically in the policy. Now, in the early years of an ordinary life policy, they are heavily front-end loaded, which means I put $2,500 into the policy year one, and my cash value is likely zero. I put another $2,500 in year two, and the likelihood is my cash value is zero or very, very low. If you buy a cash value whole life policy, the internal rates of return of that policy don't really start to make sense unless you hold that policy somewhere in excess of 15 to 20 years. So it is a long-term purchase. You just can't buy ordinary life insurance or universal life for 5 to 10 years. That doesn't make sense. Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And for a long time now has been joining us on a regular basis on Friday once a month to talk about money management and answer questions. So if you have a question about your own financial situation, call us 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also send email to will-talk@illinois.edu. The next caller here is in Edgewood, and they are on line number one. Hello.
Hello, David.
Yes.
You mentioned we are being taxed to death. The current federal tax rates are the lowest in the last 50 to 60 years or so, I've read. Do you mean state and property taxes? Because we've been trying the supply-side tax rate since 2001.
Well, I'm simply saying that...
given us the promised results.
Well, I'm saying that simply that if we add all of our taxes together...
I'm self-employed, and I pay 15% self-employment tax, and everybody talks about high taxes. Well, Mitt Romney paid like 14%, and I pay 15%, and then we pay all the other taxes.
Right. And the bottom line is you and I are alike because I'm also in private practice, and I pay that same self-employment tax of 15%, plus I pay my federal tax rates, plus I pay my state tax rates, plus I pay my real estate tax rates.
Do you see why people would think it's unfair that 14% is way too low? Do you see why people would think that's unfair? Plus we pay our own health insurance and that sort of thing. Do you see why people would be upset at that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But many people are paying at the rate of 40 to 50% of every dollar when they add up all of their taxes. That's all I'm saying.
Mitt Romney paid 40 to 50%.
Well, we're not really arguing about Mitt Romney. We're simply saying that you and I are paying a great deal of tax. Okay, but your point is well taken, and thank you so much.
All right, we'll go on here. Let's go to Urbana. This is our next caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have an observation and a question. I really agree with you on the cost of living. What you might call household items, food and supplies, do seem to be rising quite rapidly, and I think that's largely a result of the high prices of agricultural commodities, which affect that limited range of costs. My observation is this affects low-income and medium-income people far more than it does upper-income, where it's a fairly negligible part of their expenditures. My question is, would it be better if the cost of living were computed as at least two numbers, one for household expenses, groceries, and that sort of thing, and then an overall cost of living? Or would you have another way of breaking that down?
Well, those are great observations and great questions. And interestingly enough, there are more than 200 ways that the Bureau of Labor Statistics actually measures prices and indexes. And I could spend hours and hours talking about it, but it seems to me for excellent reading is simply go to Consumer Price Index. I believe it's actually the first written offering on Google that you will see that, and you can read all about it. But when it asks how the index is actually figured out, it does cover food and beverages, housing, apparel, transportation, medical care, recreation, education. It's really through about 200 different categories of items, and it literally sends people out from the Bureau to get prices on all of these different areas, as well as interviewing a sample of some 14,000 plus families per year. So it is a rather impressive array of statistics that come together. However, a great deal of that index, it seems to me, is weighted based on housing, which has actually decreased as a result of our recession, and interest rates, which have stayed relatively low. So I think that index, from my vantage point, is certainly understated, and it is terribly troublesome to the many, many seniors and people who are retired that are on fixed income. But I agree with you that it makes very, very good sense, and your observation that inflation impacts people differently is certainly correct. But I would certainly suggest that you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics.gov/CPI. You can just actually put that URL in And there's just some excellent reading on this topic.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller. We have a couple of other people we'll get to in just a moment here. Our guest in this hour of focus is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. It's our monthly show on money management. We'll take more questions in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here Monday through Friday from 10 until noon, and we have different topics for you every day. In the second hour today, the 11 o'clock hour, Dr. Ellen Jacobson will be here. She is a dermatologist with a practice in Urbana, so we'll be talking about skin. I'm sure we'll talk a lot about sun and the issue of sun exposure, but anything else that has to do with skin, we'll take the call. Monday morning at 10 o'clock, it's our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies will be here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So we got some household problem needs to be solved. We'll do that. And then another health topic Monday at 11, Dr. Suzanne Troopin will be here. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, and every other month, always on a Monday, she is on the program. We answer questions about women's health. You can check the schedule, find out what we'll do for the rest of next week by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past Focus shows that way. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. You can also check us out on Facebook. In this hour, we're taking questions on money management. We do it once a month, always on a Friday. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's a clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And we have built this program into the schedule to try to give you a predictable opportunity to ask really practical questions specific to your own financial situation. So, you know, you have some kind of investing or money management question, you can call us. And Dave will help. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back to the phones here. The next caller is in Urbana and on line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hi. I wonder if David could comment on the College Illinois situation. I've been paying in for the past 4 years for my 7 and 10-year-old and wonder if I'm ever going to get that money out.
I think you are.
Okay.
I think you are. Basically, there's no question it's been mismanaged. I thought from the very beginning, I thought it was a tremendous deal for the investor because the program was based upon some theoretical models that I thought were just fallacious. Mainly, they underestimated what in the world tuition and fees were going to do. When you suggest that tuition and fees are going to go up somewhere between 3 and 5% a year and they've been trucking along at 8 to 10%, something has to give. The other thing, of course, that happened is that we have entered for a number of years now a very low interest rate environment. So as a result, people are stretching for yield and they are taking more chances with the money, i.e. enter College Illinois. But even though it is not backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Illinois, and I think when most people went into it, they felt it was, I think it would just be political suicide to leave these tens of thousands of families in the lurch. So my view is, while fiscally the program has difficulty, I think from a political standpoint, there would be hundreds of thousands of people marching on Springfield, and the legislators would not be allowed out of their House and the Senate until they guaranteed those financial instruments. So I think that's what's really going to happen. So you have children 7 to 10 years old. While I might not add more to the program, depending upon which particular program you're in, I think that you are going to see that money paid out.
One more then follow-up. I am paying for the next 8 years on both of them, and do you think I should discontinue paying any more in to fulfill the contract or cut my losses and leave what's there?
No, I think if you're on that monthly basis, I would continue to support the program.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, thank you, David.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And again, to line number 1, this is another caller. This is someone who is in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hi. Go ahead.
Just to summarize my financial situation, I'm able to put 15% of my income in a 401k into a targeted retirement fund. But where I'm looking at now is emergency cash. I have money in a very conservative credit union, almost at a CD rate. But on top of that, I am putting cash into, for available cash, into a Vanguard Wellesley Fund, which I believe right now it's at 60%, I think, investment-grade bonds and 40%, pretty much blue chip.
That's correct. It's, it's about a 60-40 asset allocation.
Yes. Do you think that's a wise move for available cash with world markets the way they're going right now, or do you think that's pretty conservative for accumulating cash?
Well, I think that's pretty aggressive. Vanguard Wellesley has had a wonderful track record, but keep in mind any type of stock mutual fund with a 40% exposure to U.S. and international stocks could drop at any point in time. That fund could certainly drop 10 or 15% in a correction. The real issue is, would you bail out? Because I think historically that fund has been extremely well managed, done very well. But for day-to-day cash, you're much better off in the credit union or the bank at these paltry interest rates if you need a true emergency fund. If you're in Vanguard Wellesley, I'm not going to be convinced that that's money for a true emergency, because you may be forced to take that money out when it is lower than what you placed into it.
In the credit union, I've got 8 months of emergency fund.
Okay, that's very, very good. That's terrific. Now, when you say 8 months of emergency funds, is that 8 months of expenses?
Yes.
Okay. So I feel pretty good about that. Typically, 6 to 8 months is a pretty nice cushion. So as a result, I feel a little bit more comfortable in Wellesley. It's a great fund, don't misunderstand me, but definitely 6 to 8 months of economic cushion makes great sense in any event.
So in a downturn, that would maybe help prevent a sellout with if the Wellesley fund took a nosedive.
Right. Right, and remember that like any fund, if you had to access a fund, you dollar cost average out of a fund just like you dollar cost average in. You don't sell it all at once. So if you needed to take, if you had $10,000 in the fund or $20,000, you might take out $1,000 a month. So you average out of a fund just as you are averaging in with 15% of your earnings going into a 401k, which is very laudable.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Very good. Again, thank you. And we'll keep going and talk next with someone in Urbana and line number two.
Hi. Thanks very much for providing the service.
Sure.
I appreciate it. My father passed away and left two 457 accounts to my mother.
Yes.
And I know very little about 457 accounts, and I'm wondering what to do with this. Are there unique rollover opportunities at this time?
Well, it depends, but typically you should be able to roll that money over, or you could leave it in the 457 account. Now, it is not going to have an immediate taxable event because this money is going to a surviving spouse. It may be subject to being included in an estate tax, but unless the estate is several millions of dollars, then there probably is no estate tax impact either. 457 money is sort of like 401k money. If you're familiar with 401ks?
Not as much as I should be.
Okay. Well, these are tax-deferred savings accounts where money from a place of work has been placed into a tax-deferred savings vehicle. And the 457 accounts have certain choices. There should be a menu of choices of how to invest that money. Now, how old's your mom?
She's in her 80s.
Okay. So she is required to take certain distributions on an annual basis out of these 457 accounts. Alternatively, she could roll those 457 accounts into a self-directed IRA program and, again, be subject to minimum distributions. The point is that whatever she takes out of these accounts will be subject to federal income tax. There's just no way around it because the money was put in on a pre-tax basis and grew on a tax-deferred basis. So the good news is that once she has these monies, the sort of good news is, hey, I'm over 70 and a half, and I need to start taking this money out in the form of minimum distributions. So I would suggest that you talk to your accountant or a financial advisor as to two questions. One, how much money do we have to take out and when? And then two, what would be an appropriate menu of investment choices given her overall situation?
They suspended the minimum payments once I notified them of my father's passing, and it's actually been several months now without any distributions. Is it possible to vary the amount of distributions to get caught up so we don't have to pay tax penalties?
Well, I don't think you're going to have to pay tax penalties because there is a period of time. Typically, if you take a distribution probably by December of this year, there wouldn't be any tax penalty. Again, we have to look at the date of death, to look at the contract, but I believe if you take it by December of 2012, you should be okay. But again, I would suggest that you counsel with your financial advisor.
And if I don't have a financial advisor, what's the best way to find one locally?
Well, I think a certified financial planner is a good start. Look for certified financial planners, CFPs. So under the Yellow Pages or on the Internet, look for certified financial planners, visit with at least two of them, find out who you have chemistry with, and then talk to them. They should be willing to provide you how they charge. Typically, certified financial planners often charge on an hourly basis, much like a lawyer or another professional, and it would certainly be worthwhile to spend an hour or two with a talented CFP.
What are the typical rates for these folks?
Anywhere from $150 to $300 an hour.
Okay, great. All right, well, thank you very
much. All right, very good. And we'll just keep going. We have about 10 minutes left, by the way, in this Hour of Focus with David Sinnoh. It's our monthly program on money management. You have questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Danville, line 4. Hello.
Hello, yes. I was wondering if there is a rule of thumb concerning which retirement pension option is better, either taking it as an annuity or rolling it over into an IRA? Is there a rule of thumb?
There really is not a rule of thumb, but it's a fabulous question. Interestingly enough, most people roll it over into their own IRA as opposed to annuitizing the benefit. And for most people, over the last 10 years, in a particularly low interest rate environment, in a particularly very, very tough stock market, they would have been far better off annuitizing the benefit. Before you make that choice, however, of what that annuity is, let me ask a couple of questions. One, is that annuity a fixed annuity? In other words, is the amount of money that you would receive every month always going to be the same?
Well, I'm now retired, and it was the account was called a 401A.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I'm no longer adding to it. The company put in, I didn't put anything into it, just the company did.
Well, that was good. And now you're faced with the choice of rolling it all over or taking a fixed annuity. Is that the choice?
Yes, that's it.
Okay. What you would need to do, I think, is sit down again with a financial counselor and do the following mathematics. Tell the financial counselor, obviously, your age, because he or she can then figure out your life expectancy. Are you married?
No.
Okay. Your single life expectancy can do that. Secondly, they can take the lump sum distribution, which you would be entitled to, and they can compare that to the actual payment in lieu of that lump sum, called an annuity, and then they can work backwards and tell you what that interest rate or that investment rate really is that the insurance company would be paying you. Understand? So in other words, let's say that you're 65 years of age and you are likely to live under actuarial tables for a male in good health, maybe to 85. So that's a 20-year payout. And let's just say that your annuity payout would be $2,000 a month versus a lump sum of $300,000 or $200,000. Your financial advisor can take those numbers and can determine what the imputed interest rate is or internal rate of return that company would be paying you, and then you can compare that with, gee, it's only 1%. I think I can do better on my own. So we have to have a grounds for comparison, and most folks need someone who understands present values, future values, time values of money to help you with that calculation. So you are best advised to find someone, a financial planner, even a most certified public accountants can do that math for you.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right,
my pleasure.
Good. Thank you.
I also want to thank David for all of his great years of service. I followed you for a long time.
Well, I'm not sure which of us you're thanking. We'll both say thanks.
Oh, David Inge.
Oh, okay. Thank
well,
you.
Both of you. I've heard you both
thank
many
you.
Times.
All right. Well, I appreciate that very much. Thanks.
Okay.
We'll go on here for about another 5 minutes. Over to another caller here. This is line one in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. It's been tied up. I didn't want to introduce this at the very end, but there were some broad conversations about tax policy and other things like that, not just a strictly investment policy. And in the past, David Sinnell has usually given a rundown of big events, and I think it might be good to say just a few words about the JP Morgan Chase thing. And what I've been distressed with is that it seems like the way that I've heard an earlier chat show discuss it is that the government wants to stop the bank from doing risky bets with their money, and without any acknowledgement that these are federally insured funds to a large extent, and even if that's not a concern for some people, then it's just a too big to fail bank, so they can get bailed out again like they were, even though, again, J.P. Morgan says that they didn't need it. So a few words on that, and since this is a swan song show, I've heard rumors about Professor Sinnell's leaving from Strategic Capital Management. Maybe he summarized it or characterized it earlier on an earlier show, but I don't know if he wants to even bother with that at this point. But like I said, I've heard.
Well, let me clear up a couple of things.
Like, but.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the questions. Those are great questions. With reference to J.P. Morgan Chase, it now looks like the $2 billion debacle is turning into a $5 billion debacle. And naturally, the government is concerned because that may represent risk capital of the bank, and a lot of that capital came on the backs of all of the depositors of the bank, and the government is backing the deposits, obviously, to the tune of $250,000. On the other hand, J.P. Morgan Chase is projected to make a profit, people seem to forget this, of some $20 billion this year. So in terms of $5 billion loss, it's cowboy trading. It was out of control. It needs to be reined in, no question. And I think we're going to see a lot of repercussions about it. But is this going to have a material impact on J.P. Morgan Chase in the long run? The answer is clearly no. With respect to the second question, it's been more than 10 years since I retired from Strategic Capital. And that company was sold a couple of times. And actually, it is no longer in existence. But many of the people who were involved in it have gone on to have wonderful careers in the money management and banking business, either themselves or with other institutions.
All right. I have an email question here I'd like to try to get, and then we'll see if we can get one more call. We have someone who writes in that they have about $130,000 in stock, bond, mutual funds at a local brokerage. They are 8 years from retirement. They write, given that you have educated me throughout the years, should I transfer my funds to manage on my own, into something like the couch potato fund, or should I leave it where it is? The person says, my broker doesn't really suggest much in the way of changes. He usually just lets things ride. So what are your thoughts?
Okay, well, number one, if you have a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds, that's probably a good thing. But let's go back to the broker and ask the broker a series of questions. How have I done? That's really the major question. I've had this money with you X number of years, so why don't you provide me with a year-to-year rundown of how my investment has performed? A broker can certainly do this. They can come up with the actual rate of return that you have earned on an annualized basis. And then what is the benchmark that I should be compared to? Is it, for example, the Vanguard Balanced Fund? That would be an example. So why don't we go back to our broker and ask the two acid questions. One, how have I done over the last number of years? Give that information to me a year to year and on an annualized basis. And two, what's our benchmark? What's our bogey? What are we being compared to? And then three, the last question is, give me a look into the future, at least mathematically. Based upon the portfolio that I now have that you've put together for me, what is my expected rate of return? What should I expect? That's a fair question. And then to one and two standard deviations, what is the range of the upside as well as the range of the downside? So before you make any move, you need to have a heart-to-heart talk with your broker so you can better understand where you've been and where he or she is projecting you to be in the future.
Okay. One more. Decatur, line two. Hello.
Hello, and let me first say just how fabulous it's been over the last several years being able to listen to David on the show, and we appreciate his service to us.
Thank you.
And now to a quick question. I inherited a T. Rowe Price fund from when my father passed away several years ago, plus or minus $9,000 value. It grew nicely, and in 2010, I redeemed it and moved it into a different investment. The IRS has just sent me a wonderful letter saying, you owe lots of thousands of dollars on this because it was worth about $32,000 when I redeemed it. Is that really the case?
Okay, let me ask you quickly. Was this after-tax money, or was this inside an IRA or something like that?
No, this was just plain old dad's investment.
You got to go back and figure out your basis in this investment. Your basis will be your fair market value at the date of death, plus, did you hold on to this investment for a number of years then?
Several.
Okay, you've got to add back in all of the dividends that you paid year by year on your tax return. So go back to T. Rowe Price dividends for all of those years, add that to the original $9,000, and the difference between the $32,000 and whatever that number is your long-term capital gain. And then you will pay probably 15% on that gain. So let's say that 9 with the dividends was 18. 32 minus 18 is 14. 15% of 14, whatever that number is, it's about $2,000. And then that's how you figure it. So you got to go back and make sure you got your basis right.
Okay, 2,000 is better than 8,000. Thanks, David.
Yes.
All right. Well, there we got to finish with the promise that we will do this show again next month, but with Kevin Wasby, who's a lecturer in finance at U of I. And if people have listened to this show, they've heard his voice.
He's they certainly have.
Before. But again, we just want to express our appreciation for more than 20 years of service to Dave Sinno for doing this show. And I guess every once in a while, we'll continue to see you.
Huh? Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure that Kevin will invite me back on any number of occasions. And as I say, once again, it's been just a sincere pleasure to be affiliated with what I think is the greatest public radio station in the country.
All right. Thank you.